One of the students, one of the Talmidim in Olagola, several years ago, once told me that when he goes to Rabbi Gottlieb's classes, so one of the most important svarim that he brings along is an English dictionary. So it's my pleasure to invite a dear friend and colleague, Rabbi David Gottlieb.
I would like to share with you some observations about the way in which discussions sometimes develop when we are talking about statements in Chazal, analyzing them and drawing out their implications. Often enough, we start with what Chazal wrote, and then we get into a discussion, and as we are talking, the formulation changes. The words change. Usually the words get shorter, clearer, more precise, and the consequences we are dealing with become very radical, and we're very worried about the consequences that we think Chazal are committed to. And we don't stop and ask, if our formulation is shorter and clearer and more precise, why didn't Chazal use that formulation? Why did they beat around the bush? Why did they speak vaguely with ambiguity? Maybe it's because they don't mean what we're discussing. And maybe the radical conclusions that we're worried about aren't their conclusions, but they're just our conclusions because we haven't remained with their original thought. I'm going to give you some examples of how this happens. I'm told that in certain yeshivas, there's a rule. When you discuss how to analyze what is a kinyan, and what is shmira, and what is a psul, and you get your formulation, your definition, your justification, you have to go back into the Gemara and reread the words and read your words back into the Gemara, where every time such a word is used, you push in your definition to see whether it really fits. That is a very important methodology. And as I will show you in some of the discussions of the more philosophical passages, this rule is often not obeyed. Chazal say, Kol ha'omer, David chata, eina elatoa. Anyone who says King David sinned is making a mistake. And it says it about Reuven and various other people as well. This is referring to the incident with Bathsheba. Anyone who says David did not sin is making a mistake. So the discussion usually goes like this. What? He didn't sin? Of course he sinned. Didn't Nathan the prophet confront him on the throne and tell him you've sinned? Didn't he say, Chatosi Lashem, I've sinned to God? Didn't he pay a terrible burden, a terrible price for the sin that he committed? How could Chazal say he didn't sin? But now let's think. Chazal did not use the words, David lo chata. David didn't sin. Chazal said, anyone who says that David sinned is making a mistake. Why did they use that much longer formulation? Why did they refer to what a person will say and whether he's making a mistake or not? If what Chazal is saying is that David didn't sin, they should have said David didn't sin, and they didn't say that. And as a matter of fact, if you look into the Mefarshim, even Rashi on the sugi there in Shabbos, and Rav Desta has a whole essay on this, you'll see what Chazal are telling us is, if you think you understand what his sin was, then you're making a mistake. If you say on your authority that David committed a sin, then that means you're claiming you understand what the sin was. You're making a mistake. Of course he sinned. Of course he sinned. But what was the sin? And on the surface, the sin that the person will make a mistake in thinking he committed is one of Eish HaSish. And in deeper levels, even that needs more work to be able to be understood in some way or other. But had the discussion stopped to realize that Chazal didn't say David didn't sin, it said anyone who says, then they might have saved themselves the worry over that clearly false conclusion. Here's another one that Rodesta points out. Kosha Rima Lemeis Kemachat the Basar Chai. The worm that eats the corpse is as difficult for the dead as a needle is for living flesh. Now, seasoned Talmid Chachamim know better than to try to penetrate this. But beginners say, what are you telling me? Dead flesh doesn't feel anything. The neurons don't work. There are no neural pulses to the brain. The brain doesn't register anything. What is this, some kind of magic? Some kind of superstition? That dead disintegrating bodies still have sensation? But Rav Dessler points out that the formula that Chazal give us is not equal. It's not parallel. It says the worm is difficult for the dead as the needle is for living flesh. Why did Chazal use the word flesh only in the second half and not in the first half? They could have used it twice, or they could have used it zero times. They put flesh only in the second half. Because Chazal are telling us, of course dead flesh doesn't feel anything. They didn't say that the worm is difficult for the dead flesh. They said it's difficult for the dead. What they're referring to is the pain of the nefesh, the neshama, seeing the body disintegrate. And if a person is overly invested in his body, when he sees the body disintegrate, and that was the instrument of all his pleasures, so it's as painful to the soul to see the body disintegrate as it is for a needle to be injected into living flesh. Once you pay attention to what Chazal said, all the difficulties of disintegrating bodies carrying sensation disappear, because that isn't what Chazal said. Another one, which is very famous in the yeshiva world, Kinas Sofrim Tar Bechochma. If you've ever been to a real Beis Medrash in the heat of learning, and you see the people pounding their desks and yelling and screaming at each other and gesticulating wildly, and then the justification is, that the Gemara says, Kinas Sofrim, the zealousness, should be translated, the zealousness of the Sofrim increases wisdom, increases understanding. Very few people are aware of what the Marsha says on that statement in the Talmud. Marsha says the designation Sofrim is not a top level. The top level designation of a scholar is Chachamim, the wise. Here, the formula uses the word Sofrim. Says the Marsha, this is level 2, not level 1. When you're on level 2, when you're still developing, when you're still growing, when you need the heat of battle to motivate you to be focused and on target, yes, it will have beneficial results, but it is not the top level. Indeed, the Marsha quotes, "Divrei chachamim benachas nishmoim." The words of the wise are heard peacefully. And the Gemara says that the learning in the land of Israel was superior to that of Babylonia because nochim zeh lezeh b'halacha. They were congenial to one another, friendly to one another, easy in their interactions with one another. So instead of building a whole psychology that Torah is based on conflict, it's a very male expression as against the female expression, so forth and so on. That's all based on not paying attention to the fact that the Chazal used the word Sofrim instead of Chachamim. And reading the Marsha to realize that this is a lower level, not a higher level. I'm not discouraging anybody from fighting with the Chavrusas, because most of us are on the beginning level where we're still developing and still need that reinforcement. But to build it into an ideology, to build it into a whole psychology of Torah study, it seems to me, according to Marsha, is a mistake, because it doesn't pay careful enough attention to the exact formulation Chazal used. There's a famous statement in Chazal that everyone knows, Atem Kruim Odom Veina Akum Kruim Odom. Literally, it says, you, the Jewish people, are called Adam, and those who are not Jews, serve idols, are not called Adam. Well, I don't have to tell you what the imagination can do with that. Only we are really human and others are not really human, and we can go on and on with that kind of imagination. But just notice that the Chazal put in the word kruyim, called. It didn't say you are Adam and they're not Adam. It says you are called Adam and they're not called Adam. If the point is to communicate the essence of the Jewish people as against the essence of other people, why make mention of what we're called? Who cares what we're called? This discussion ought to be as to what we are. The truth is that Chazal is referring to Odom ki yomus ba'ohel. It's talking about tumas meis, that a Jew communicates tumas meis via ohel, and a non-Jewish corpse does not communicate tumas meis via ohel, though it does from touching, but it does not via ohel. It's a very specific, limited law. I wouldn't say that law doesn't have implications. Of course it has implications, but the implications that are read into it are not there because they didn't pay attention to one word, kruim. You're called Adam. Once you pay attention to that word, the scope of the idea is very much restricted. Here's one that causes many people difficulty, especially when you're teaching and teaching beginners. Eilu ve'eilu divrei Elokim chayim. These and these are the words of the living God. The thought is, when you're dealing with a difference of opinion, an argument, a disagreement, a contradiction, Chazal are pronouncing that these and these are the words of the living God. And the question then becomes, how could two sides of a contradiction both be true? How could that be? And a great deal of imagination is exerted trying to figure out how that could be, or maybe it's deep and mystical, and we're not supposed to understand it, it's a limit to the human intellect, not to get to divine realities, and so forth and so on. But now let's reflect. It doesn't say, Eilu ve'eilu emes, these and these are true, it doesn't say that. That's not a correct translation for emes either. Maybe we'll go into that some other time. Just have to put that in as a footnote. Eilu ve'eilu emes, it doesn't say. It says, Eilu ve'eilu divrei Elokim chayim. These and these are the words of the living God. If Chazal wanted to communicate to us that both sides are true, they should have said these are both emes. And they didn't say that. So the first thought that arises in a person's mind is, well, then what did Chazal mean? If they don't mean what I'm saying, they must mean something else. Then it's a good idea to take a look at the commentaries. There are a number of different commentaries, not one of which that I have found, says that both sides of a contradiction are true. There's a famous Ritva in Erevin who says that each halacha was given with 49 ta'amim, 49 reasons to hold one way, and 49 reasons to hold the opposite way. And therefore, when the Chachamim debate the issue, every reason that each side presents is a divinely inspired reason, a divinely authorized reason. These are all words of the living God. All the reasons presented are genuine reasons. But it says nothing at all about the Psak. The actual legal decision is not called these and these are the words of the living God. Rashi and Ksuba says something very similar, though he doesn't refer to God giving it. He says the same thing about a debate among the sages, that they bring proofs from other genuine Torah sources. And that's what it means when it says these and these are the words of the living God. Indeed, Rashi makes the following remark based on a Gemara. Let's imagine two Amoraim say things which seem to be contradictory. And we later have two ways to explain what they say. Either they're disagreeing about how to understand what their Rebbe said, or they're disagreeing about what words the Rebbe spoke. So Rashi says it's always preferable to interpret their statement as disagreeing about what the Rebbe's words meant than disagreeing about what words the Rebbe spoke. Because if it's the latter disagreement, if they're disagreeing about what the Rebbe spoke, one side is sheker. That's Rashi's word. One side is false. On what the Rebbe said, which is a fact of what he spoke, we don't say Elohim Chaim. If it's a question of analyzing what he said could be applied one way or another way, there may be ambiguity, there may be room for other principles to be added to what the Rebbe said to get different conclusions, all of that could go into Divrei Elohim Chaim. Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zechat HaVadar Lebracha, in Hakdamah to one of the volumes on Or Chaim, says, even in Psak, when two posts can come to contradictory Psak, you can say, Eilu ve'eilu divrei Elokim chayim, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the Torah, he gave it over to the poskim to apply it. When the posek learns the background and applies his knowledge and his understanding to arrive at a conclusion, that process is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants him to do. Since he wants him to do it, his words are divrei Elokim chayim. That doesn't mean they're true. Indeed, Rav Moshe says, even if it doesn't agree with what HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows, even if it doesn't agree with what HaKadosh Baruch Hu intends, it's still the Elohim Chaim, because he's carried out the process that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted from him. So from being a crashing difficulty, a difficulty that's illogical and calls forth all sorts of objections and unease in the beginning student, if you analyze, number one, what they said, and you analyze what the Mefarshim say on it, you can avoid yourself all of that problem because you pay more close attention to what Chazal really said. We just read Parshas Chukas. And everybody knows that the Paraduma is a puzzle, a problem, a chok, an enigma, something which it's impossible to understand. How could it be that one element could purify the impure and defile the pure? How could one element have opposite effects of that kind? That's supposed to be something which is unfathomable by the human mind. And indeed, where the Midrash talks about this, at the end it says, Ha'oski b'poro mitzchilo ve'atzof, mitame begodim, those who are involved in preparing the red heifer, contract tumah, he gufa mitaharis begodim, but when you apply the ashes of the red heifer on the water to a person who's tummy, it makes him pure, makes him clean. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, chuka chakakti, gzeira gazarti, God says, I established a law, I made a decree, iyat ha-rashai la'avur al gzeirasa, you cannot violate my decree. And this is taken as a statement that this is beyond understanding, beyond belief. You just have to accept it because there's no logic to it whatsoever. Okay, let me ask you a question. Is the idea that there's an object or a thing which has opposite effects on different things really paradoxical, impossible to understand? Okay, you multiply a number by minus one and you change its sign. You change a positive number into a negative number and a negative number into a positive number. That's somehow deeply paradoxical. There are medicines which can cure ill people, but if healthy people take them, they'll make them sick. Is that somehow a deep, difficult paradox? Something impossible to understand? You take an object that has a certain temperature, put it in contact with something cooler, it'll heat it up. Put it in contact with something warmer, it'll cool it down. It has opposite effects on different things. Why would anyone think that we're dealing with an unfathomable paradox here? These are things that are common in everyday life. But now if you read the beginning of the Medrash, you'll see that Chazal expressed themselves in a very, I would say, clear way by the style that they use. The Medrash starts with a verse from Job, from Eov, which says, "Mi yitein tahor mitamei lo echad." Who will produce pure from impure? Is it not one, meaning the one of the world, Yechido Shel Olam, God? And now it starts to give examples. One set of examples is Abraham comes from Terach. His father was an idol worshiper. Chizkiyo Omayachaz, the great king Chizkiyo, from his father who was an idol worshiper. Yoshiyahu Ma'amon, Mordechai Vishimi, Yisrael Mi'ovdei Kochavim, the Jewish people from a whole world of others who served idols. Ha'olam Abo, Mi'olam Azeh, the world to come from the world, from our world. In every case, the product is superior to the basis from which it's produced. There's an upward development. Well, we normally think you don't get in better, they don't get out better than what you put in. So here you have a lower stratum platform out of which a much higher, superior product grows. So then the Medrash says, Mi asake, mi tzivake, mi gazake. Who did so? Who commanded so? Who decreed so? Lo yechido shel olam. Isn't it the one of the world, God? I suggest to you that this is not an expression of astonishment. This is a question and an answer. Who set it up that low-grade preparation can give birth to a high-grade product? God did. Because God is biased on the side of development. God is biased on the side of the pure. God is biased on the side of the holy. This is not an expression of astonishment. It's recording HaKadosh Baruch Hu's position. It's recording his policy of dealing with the world. The Medrash goes on to say that if you have a tiny white splotch on your skin, baheres, kegris, it makes a person tameh, he has tzaras. But if the whole skin takes on that color, the person is tahor, is pure. So you think, if a tiny spot makes you tameh, and your whole skin is the same color, you might be, ought to be 1,000 times as tameh. No, it's not so. You happen to be pure if that happens. Now the Medrash repeats the words, Mi tzivake, mi osake, mi tzivake, mi gozake. Who did this? Who commanded this? Who decreed this? Lo yichido shel olam. Isn't it the one of the world? Again, a bias on the side of purity. No one's shocked that a small splotch makes you tummy. That's what Taras is. Taras is defined by small slotches. But that the whole skin takes on that color and becomes tar, that's the surprise. And the Medrash says, yes, because that's how God runs the world. God runs the world in a way that lower class raw materials can produce a higher class product. Now, the Midrash says, but the Parah Aduma has double effect. It's the most powerful purifier that we have in the whole Jewish Torah. And yet all those who participate in producing it become Tamei. That's a paradox in God's policy. It's not a paradox in mathematics. It's not a paradox in medicine. It's not a paradox in physics. It's a paradox in God's policy. Once you know that God is consistently biased on the side of purity and holiness, to find an item which purifies and also defiles, that's very difficult to understand. And that's why the Medrash does not use that phraseology again. Mi osake, mi tzivake, mi gozake. It doesn't say that. All it says is, I made a decree and you have to follow it. As a matter of fact, the Midrash goes on to say that Moshe Rabbeinu understood this. Those who think that it's an insuperable problem beyond the possibility of human understanding, Moshe Rabbeinu understood it. And in Olam Haba, wherever stage of future development that is, we all will understand it. And indeed, Rav Dessler in Michta Miyolo has an explanation of it, an explanation of why it does what it does. The message of Medrash seems to be, with your own research, you won't be able to understand it. But from Nevuah, there is a reason for it. There is a reason. Most Rishonim hold that it's a reason for everything. But it has to come from Nevuah. So Moshe Rabbeinu had it. We will have it, Lasi Lavo. But Shlomo HaMelech, who tried to analyze it with his own knowledge, Amarti Echkama, V'Yirachokam Mimeni, I said I will do it through Chochma, through wisdom. No, that you cannot have. But if you pay careful attention again to the way Chazal put their description, you see that it doesn't have the effects that it seems to have. And then the examples from mathematics and medicine and physics are no problem at all. There is a statement in Chazal, Ein lemedim in a klolos. We don't learn absolute facts from general statements. You have come across a statement in Chazal, all A's are B's, you have to expect that there'll be exceptions. When Chazal said that, and don't think that this is a mistake, that's how Chazal expressed themselves. They used general expression when it was usually true, mostly true, to be expected to be true, but you can also expect exceptions. And this is Rabbi Yochanan speaking. He goes on to say, Afilu b'makom shenema b'chutz. Even if the statement is, all A's are B's except for X, Y, Z, and you think, well, now the Torah explicitly specified the exceptions, so surely those are all the exceptions? No. Rabbi Yochanan says, not true. And he gives examples from halacha. That is not true. That means when you come across general statements, you have to be very wary. You have to be on the lookout for possibility of limitations as to where it applies, or open exceptions. Ein mazel l'Yisrael. Jewish people does not live under the control of a constellation or a sar, some kind of angelic entity that stands between us and God. We are under the direct control and direct direction of God Himself. That's the way it's usually read and understood. Well, the Gemara gives an example of this. Indeed, it's the incident from which this law is, or this principle is derived. Shmuel, the great Amora, was sitting with a non-Jewish astrologer named Ablat. They were friends. There are a number of incidents where they were sitting together. Indeed, the Gemara says that Ablat was careful not to touch Shmuel's wine because he knew that Shmuel couldn't drink it. So they were very careful to keep his hands off Shmuel's cup. They were sitting and watching as a group of Jewish workers went out to the swamp to cut reeds. And Ablat pointed to one of them and said, he's not coming back. He's going to die out there. And Shmuel said, no, he will come back. Okay, some hours passed. They all come trooping back, including that one whom Shmuel said would come back. Shmuel called him over and said, empty out your sack, the sack of cut reeds. He emptied them out, and in it was a poisonous snake sliced in half. They were using a cutting tool. So Shmuel said to the worker, did anything unusual happen today? He says, yes, our custom is that we all bring food, we put it together in a common store, and then we share it out equally for lunch. One of the fellow workers didn't have food today, so I put in for him. Shmuel said, Tzedakah tatzil mimavis, charity saves from death. And the Gemara concludes, from here we see that ain mazal Yisrael. There's no heavenly force in between God and the Jewish people. That's the end of the story. Tosfos asks, was Ablat really wrong? Wasn't there a poisonous snake waiting for that worker? There was a poisonous snake in his bag. So clearly Ablat saw this poisonous snake that was waiting for him. So what is the message of the Gemara? Yes, there is mazal. Mazal operates, and it operates on Jews as well, but we can climb above it. We're capable of climbing above it. That's why Shmuel asked him, did something unusual happen today? If nothing unusual happened, you'd be dead. But something unusual happened. The Pasuk says, Tzedakah tatzil mimavis, charity saves from death. It means death is there. Death is there, but you can be saved from it if you do something that puts you above. All of a sudden, the idea of Ein Mazal Yisrael comes out to be a very limited idea. And then, we're living now in the 3 weeks. About this time, there are two statements which challenge the idea of Ein Mazal Yisrael. One is that if you have a litigation with a non-Jew, now's not a good time to do it. Try to wait till after Tisha B'Av, because it's a time of Mazal Ra. Mazal Ra? Didn't we learn Ein Mazal Yisrael? The Ritva says, sure, Ein Mazal Yisrael, except for the 3 weeks, in which case there is a mazal, and it's a bad mazal. And that's not a good time to have a fight with a non-Jew. So it means Ein Mazal Yisrael, but the 3 weeks are an exception to that. So once you look into the Mefarshim, this is not a question of formulation, but the Mefarshim, you see that what looks like a general statement isn't. And if it isn't a general statement, then one has to realize that it's much more limited in its scope, and you can thereby avoid counterexamples that might be difficult to answer. Chazal say that tzitzis is shkula keneged kol mitzvahs. The mitzvah of tzitzis is weighted equally with the other 612 mitzvahs. Now, even without looking around, that's very hard to understand. There are mitzvahs for which violation causes the death penalty. There are mitzvahs that were given at Sinai. There are mitzvahs that are repeated over and over again in the Torah. There are positive mitzvahs for which the penalty is kares, like Mila and Hakravas Korban Pesach. Are Chazal really saying that tzitzis is equal to all of those? It has equal weight to all of the other mitzvahs combined? The answer is that in the third paragraph of Shema, what it says is, you put on tzitzis, you'll see it, and you'll remember and do all of the mitzvahs. That's where the equation is. Only in that. Not in reward, and not in punishment, and not in taking precedence over other mitzvahs. Tzitzis is only a conditional mitzvah. You don't have to put on tzitzis, midiraisa. If you happen to wear a four-cornered garment, it has to have tzitzis on it. And not in its promise for olam habo and all the rest, but it's a reminder. It will bring you to the others. In that one respect alone, is it equal to all the other mitzvahs. In Shir Shirim, the Melech says to his beloved, he calls her Tamasi, my pure one. The Medrash says, Atikri Tamasi ela Ta'omasi. Don't read my pure one, read my twin. Now you all know the Song of Songs, that the king is God and the beloved is the Jewish people. And here is the creator saying of a creature that we're twins. Do you understand that? Can any creature be a twin to the creator? Any finite creature be a twin to the infinite creator? I mean, and in case you didn't get it, the Midrash goes on and says, Lo ani gadol mimena, velo hi gadol mimeni. I'm not bigger than she, and she's not bigger than I am. We're equal. But what is that supposed to mean? So the Ramchal and the Das Tzvinus says, Kadosh Baruch Hu built the world in such a way that we are partners in bringing it to its perfection, and it's not going to get there unless we both do our part. He made it dependent upon us. This is the equality that we have with the Creator, that we are both necessary conditions for completing the creation. Of course, to say that A and B are both necessary doesn't mean that A and B contribute the same amount. There's a good example which is useful for many purposes. This actually happened on a number of occasions. A guy goes up an airplane, there's a pilot and a passenger, two-seater airplane, and up in the air. The pilot has a heart attack and dies. And the passenger's up there in the plane, flying, and he hasn't got a clue what to do. He hasn't got a clue. The radio is on, and he yells into the radio, "Help! The pilot just died." And somebody on the ground says, "Listen, we'll talk you down. We'll talk you down. We've done this before. We'll give you instructions. Take hold of the wheel and step on that lever and pull that button. And so on. We'll talk you down and you'll make it down." And it's actually succeeded in some, on some occasions. Now, right, not always does it succeed. So now, the plane will not land without the person in the tower giving the instructions and the fellow who's pulling the levers. But the contribution of the two of them is surely not equal. The guy pulling the levers is just following orders. You know, his hands and arms and legs move in certain ways. The guy who's giving the instructions is the one who knows how to make it come down. Both are necessary, but the contributions aren't equal. Kadosh Baruch Hu says, "I'm making you necessary. So that when it's finished, it's the product that we both invested in and needed both of our investments." But that's all. So from a statement, "You're my twin," what you get is an extremely narrow application. That's exactly the message, that when Chazal make a statement that looks like a general statement, very often it has very narrow application. And if you, unaware, give it a broader application, then indeed, you're not going to be able to teach the truth and you're going to be subject to all sorts of difficulties. I want to finish with an observation which only came to me recently. I've been thinking about these matters in Torah Shebaal Peh for many years. But the truth is, I've been discovering recently that it's true in Torah Shebaal Ksav as well. We're just so used to some of it that we don't take it as if it were a problem, because we're used to the resolutions. But if you look at the psukim and look, read them precisely and boldly, read them like a beginner, you'll see that there would be quite important difficulties. It says, Kadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe Rabbeinu to go down to Mitzrayim, take out Klal Yisrael, and he has a raft of objections. And one of them is, "V'hein lo ya'aminu li, lo yishmu b'kol li," they won't believe me, and they won't listen to my voice or obey my voice. "Ki'omru lo nirach elech al-shem," they'll say, "Kadosh Baruch Hu didn't appear to you." So he says, throw the stick down and becomes a snake, pick it up with your hand. Kadosh Baruch Hu z'leman ya'aminu ki nirach elech al-shem, so that they'll believe that Hashem appeared to you. Then he says, put your hand into your garment, take it out, and it's leprous, put it back in. Take it out, and it's v'hinei shavak b'soro. So Kadosh Baruch Hu says, "V'hoya im lo yaminu lach v'lo yishmu l'kol ha'osa rishon," if they don't believe you and accept the message of the first miracle, "V'heminu l'kol ha'osa achron," then they will believe the message of the second os. They will believe it. You know what the next words are? And it'll be, if they don't believe in both of them, excuse me, you just told me they will believe the second sign. Now you say, and if they don't believe the second sign, so will they believe it or won't they believe it? It means when it says they will believe it, that they should believe it, they ought to believe it, it's natural to believe it, we could expect that they'll believe it, but I'm not closing the door. And if they don't, I'm giving you a third sign. Which means the first statement that they will believe isn't meant absolute. It isn't meant perfect. It's meant to give you what would be normally expected, but not something that's absolute. Similarly, the Perei Psukim, which many people know because Chazal talk about it, in Dvarim, Miketz Sheva Shanim Ta'asa Shmita, Efes ki lo yebecha evyon. Don't worry, there's nothing to be concerned about. There will not be any impoverished people. Kivarei kevech Hashem ba'aretz, she Hashem alakech nosein lecha, nosein lecha na'achla l'shto. Three psukim later, it says, ki yevicha evyon, ya'achad echecha ve'achad she'arecha ve'aretzcha, she Hashem alakech nosein lecha. When there will be an impoverished person, same word, evyon, both cases, an impoverished person, this is how you should treat him. Now, if you're reading it bold, reading it blank, reading it precise, one says there won't be, and the other says there will be. So how can that be? So Chazal say, if you follow Kodesh Baruch Hu's Ratzon in a certain way, he'll make sure there won't be. And if you don't, then there will be. We're used to the explanation, but we ought to register that on the surface you have a stira. The Torah Shebek Sav is not worried about that. Either the Torah Shebek Sav is leaning on the Torah Shebal Peh, it knows that you'll get the explanation, but the Torah Shebek Sav is written in such a way that read bold, without any elaboration, it could look like a stira. This is how all of the communications from the Kodesh Baruch Hu reach us. They reach us needing Talmud. They don't reach us plain and self-explanatory, whether they're general statements, or whether they have hidden dimensions, or whether they're stiras. We have to realize they all need to be taken into the appropriate context. Yiro Tzion, the Kodesh Baruch Hu should give us the commitment to understand the depth of Chazal. I can tell you from experience, when you go over Chazal, and then 30 years later, you finally come to an understanding, and then you say, that's why they wrote those words. Now I understand why they chose those words and not other words. It's one of the most exhilarating elements of Talmud Torah and one of the most important protections against leading people to the wrong ideas.